Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. I mean, good afternoon. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. This is your talk radio show host, Randy Fine. You know, I usually do this show at 11 in the morning, so I'm so used to for years and years and years saying good morning. But we're doing it in the afternoon, and I'm so glad that we finally were able to get together with my special guest today. We had a little bit of logistic issues, but we managed to get it worked out, and I'm really, really excited to have her with us today. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest. It's right up the alley of the work that I do and the interest that most of you who are my listeners listen in for. So today we have with us Sandra Brown, M.A., who is recognized for her pioneering work in women's issues related to relational harm from dangerous and pathological partners. Sandra Brown is the founder of the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction and Public Pathology Education. She is a former psychotherapist in the field of psychopathology, community educator on the intersections of mental illness, personality disorders, violence, and recidivism. She is a clinical lecturer and trainer, TV and radio guest, and an author. Her books include the highly popular How to Spot a Dangerous Man Before You Get Involved, the award-winning Women Who Love Psychopaths, Inside the Relationships of Inevitable Harm with Psychopaths, Sociopaths, and Narcissists, as well as the clinically relevant Counseling Victims of Violence, a Handbook for Helping Professionals. So I'm really excited to get started, and I will introduce my special guest to you now so we can do that. Good afternoon, Sandra.
Hi, Randy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being my guest. So, you know, as I mentioned to you before we went on air, this is a topic that is just so important to me and to the people that I work with, because every single person I counsel, one of the first things they say to me is, I have been to so many counselors and nobody seems to understand this. So, what is going on with that? Why is it that the mental health professionals, for the most part, do not get this?
Well, it's not taught. I'm dating myself here, but when I was in graduate school in the 1990s, the totality of information we got on personality disorders was, maybe a few days. And it was not relational. It was just the information from the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual. And so, you know, that's part of the problem. Some of the training in graduate schools is getting a little bit better in understanding more about personality disorders, but they're still not putting it into the relational context. So I think that's number one. Number two is we've had a big change, I think, in the mental health field, in which a lot of therapists are not studying psychopathology. They're studying Oprah-ology. They're getting their ideas about psychology from the positive psychology field, you know, which believes if you can think it, you can make it happen. And a lot of our clients have gone through the same thing, where they've been to counselors who, you know, approach the problem from a positive psychology slant, that personality disorders can get well if they want to. The issue is motivation and willfulness. They don't view it as the neuropsychology issue that it is. So I think a combination of both a lack of specific training on the relational aspect, and then way too much positive psychology. And positive psychology is good. It's just created for normal populations, and personality disorders are abnormal psychology. So they're trying to apply a theory to the wrong population.
Oh, so well said. I absolutely agree. And, you know, part of this positive psychology approach, part of the positive psychology approach, is that victims are supposed to see their role in this relationship, and they have no role in this relationship, because for two reasons. First of all, it's not a relationship, because a relationship takes two people. But the other thing is, it's a pure victimization. So to be asked to take some responsibility for, you know, for either solving this problem or figuring out why they were in it in the first place is so insulting, shaming, and blaming, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Right. On what planet are we responsible for someone's neuropsychology issues?
Right.
If we can't fix someone's heart condition, why do we think we can fix, you know, their neuroscience issue? So, yes. And therapists tend, if you're coming in, for instance, for relationship counseling, they're going to look at both sides of it, assuming that there's a 50-50 split in responsibility. And it's not applicable in pathological relationships.
Right. So, you know, my clients will say to me, those who have, you know, been in a couples type of relationship will say to me, so why would he or she have gone to counseling with me if he or she did not want to really try with this? And I always say,
mm-hmm.
Well, they usually go to counseling to prove that you're the crazy one.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not there to get better. They're either there because they're either forced to be there. They're trying to manipulate the counselor to believe them. But it's never, they're never there because they want to get better.
There's nothing wrong with them.
Exactly.
There's nothing wrong with that. And a lot of it is carrot dangling, you know, that if this is something that she's wanted, you know, that they will participate in. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of mental health counselors, you know, if they can't identify the pathology in the partner, they're going to proceed in trying to treat the relationship. They, you know, once pathology is identified, should never be doing relationship counseling.
Right.
But
absolutely,
that's part of the skill set they don't have in identifying it in a walking, talking relationship, not something that just had the DSM.
Right. Exactly. So tell me what your work is about.
We have been around for 30 years. I spent the first part of my career working with personality disordered people. I ran one of the largest personality disorder clinics in the state that I was living in at the time. And it was during that time period we began offering support groups to the partners of Cluster B personality disordered people. And that's really when I began to shift my focus from trying to work with personality disordered people to working with the partners and children of that. And since then, we've developed a lot of resources for survivors, some counseling retreats. At one point, we had an inpatient hospital program. We have an online recovery program, seminars, that kind of thing. And in the last couple of years, we've shifted into research, looking at that personality disordered people have highly predatory behaviors, and that we did not believe they were randomly selecting people. We thought that it was very targeted and specific. And so we just completed a research project with Purdue University that studied the personality traits that were probably being targeted in women that were in relationships with Cluster B male partners. So a lot of our work these days is highlighting sort of the research and helping people understand the trait elevations, who's at risk, and what to do about it.
So can you explain who you think or who you believe is at risk or the most vulnerable to being targeted by these personality disordered people?
Well, we've used three different instruments over the course of 10 years. So we've actually done this twice with three different instruments, and they all showed the same thing. There are two personality traits that are highly elevated in survivors that have been with Cluster Bs. And those two traits are, one is called agreeableness, which is encompasses sort of the what we call the relationship investment traits. These are women who test unusually high in traits like empathy and compassion and interestingly, optimism about human nature. They enjoy social harmony and relationships. They're kind, warm, open, approachable people. So no surprises there. Then the other trait that they test high in is called conscientiousness. And it's related to perseverance, goal-directed behavior. So they tend to make good leaders, good managers. So when they're in a relationship and there's problems, they're the ones that are very resourceful, that will seek out counseling, 12 steps, whatever. And then the perseverance, you know, really lends itself to the longevity in the relationship. Lots of people end up in relationships with Cluster B. One in five people have a personality disorder. So lots of people get in the relationship, but we are interested in studying the ones that had difficulty disengaging. And the ones that had longevity in the relationship, in what might be contributing to that other than the manipulation of the cluster B. And so this really highly elevated trait of conscientiousness that's very connected to persevering, fixing problems, not fixing people, but is goal-directed and, you know, problem-solving was another trait. So when you add those two traits of this relationship investment trait of empathy and compassion, along with the conscientiousness of persevering and goal-directed behavior, it is the two, you know, largely contributing factors to who cluster B's target.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And would you go as far as labeling some of these as having codependency issues?
No.
Okay.
Well, I shouldn't say no. The testing instruments that we use, and when this last go-round with Purdue, we tested 600 women. I mean, it was a really large sample. And women who fell within those parameters of high agreeableness and high conscientiousness, that high conscientiousness is not related to codependency. There's another factor on that testing instrument that would indicate codependency, and that would be another category, and they did not test high in that. I think the behaviors of codependency are what pathological love relationships do. I mean, I think it's a behavior that is created in the relationship, but personality is innate. We're born with personality, and so our personality doesn't highly change through the course of our lifetime, the core part of ourselves, and that's what these tests indicate. And so a lot of our clients, for instance, are judges, attorneys, doctors, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Codependency would have never allowed them to get to that position in life. Codependency, you know, is crippling, and it tends to impact all areas of your life, not just relationships. And this is, you know, one of the things that sort of caught my attention was that these women are successful in other areas of their lives except this one relationship in which no one could be successful at. So codependency would be an impact that you would have seen throughout their lifetime, not in
okay.
a single clip of just one relationship. So
okay.
I'm also sort of old school about codependency. I really think that it is a dynamic related highly to addictions, and a lot of their partners did not have addiction. So that was part of the thing that got me a little curious, is that a lot of people were labeling this codependency, but it didn't fit with the rest of their history.
Yeah, you know, what you just said clears up a whole lot for me, because you're right.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these women, they'll say to me, you know, I'm very successful. I make great decisions in my life. I'm smart. I did well in school. In every other aspect of my life, I'm really successful. How did this happen to me? So that really explains a lot for me.
Well, I just haven't met too many codependent judges, you know? I mean, what they're called to do, you know, within their profession, they would not stay a judge if they were truly codependent. I've read where a lot of people talk about that in relationship to narcissistic victim survivors or whatever, and I honestly, it makes me cringe.
Okay.
So
I'm really glad I brought that up because, you know, yeah, because that is kind of a, it's probably something I probably said too, and I am really happy to have cleared that up. So that that's great.
Part of the problem when there has been no research on this and there is no specific field training in this genre of cluster B relationships, we don't have terminology for it. And so I get it why people reach for the word that best describes what they think best describes the behavior, because no one has supplied them with any other understanding of it. And that's really why we did the research, was that people are using the terminology that's available, but a lot of the clients are saying, that's not a good fit for me.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. That's really, really important to know. So what is it about these relationships that has just creates such a hold on these women? Actually, I know that you work with women, but there's just as many men out there who are suffering from very similar situations.
Yeah.
And they say, I know in my head that this is a person I cannot be with, and yet there is this addiction to wanting to be with this person, even though I know I can't be. What is that about?
There's a couple things. I think what makes us complex to treat and complicated for a survivor to experience is that it is complicated. It's not one thing. There's a number of things that are fueling that, one of which is what I just talked about with the super traits. When you have someone that has these elevated traits in relationship investment and empathy, compassion, tolerance, trust, that's not situational. That's at the core of who they are. And so it would be like saying, if you have brown eyes, well, just walk through the world with green eyes. Just don't be that way. The core of personality is so innate that it just flows. And so I really believe that these elevated super traits are at the heart of what is problematic in disengagement with it. So that's one thing. Then there's a whole lot of neuro things that happen to the brain in these relationships. And Dr. Rhonda Freeman, who's a neuropsychologist, has worked closely with the Institute on some projects, including looking at what happens to the brain in a survivor during the relationship. And her website is neuroinstincts.com.
What is it, neuro? Say that again.
Neuroinstincts.com.
Instinct?
And she, plural.
Instinct.
Neuroinstincts.
Okay.
She has a lot of video clips in there. Gets a little techy, but she goes through the systems in the brain that get highly hyperactive or hypoactive. And so there's a lot of neuro changes in the brain that happen during the duration and especially during the breakup. You know, one of the parts of the brain that is highly activated is a part of the brain that's responsible for craving. And so they may have come to the realization that the partner is narcissistic or psychopathic, and when they say it out loud to themselves, "I miss being in a relationship with a psychopath," it's ridiculous. Of course, they don't miss a psychopath. They miss the mask, but it feels so irrational to them, and it's part of the neuro condition of the brain that's just really heightened. The other parts of the brain get heightened too, like the pain center, where the grief feels insurmountable. They may have a lot of physical pain in their body during the breakup, because the mind doesn't know emotional pain from physical pain. And there's 5 or 6 different parts of the brain, including the executive functioning part of your brain, which is the part of your brain that helps you make rational decisions. And that's been, like, dismantled, you know, during that process. And so when they need the executive functioning part of their brain the most, it's poorly functioning, and instead all these other parts of their brain are like on fire. The craving, which makes it feel like an addiction, the grief centers, the executive functioning part, you know, affects their memory and concentration. Things that you say to them in session, you have to say every session, you know, for months and months and months, because they can't retain anything.
Exactly.
And so a lot of them, you know, end up going on disability, or they take leave from, you know, their job, because their brain really is not functioning. And so, you know, you need your brain. You need your brain to break up. You need your brain to recover. You need your brain to go to counseling and be able to focus. And you have these super traits that are yearning, and then you have this craving center in your brain, and then your executive functioning isn't working. And we tell women frequently in treatment that, you know, the slowest part of recovery is the recovery to the brain, cooling down those parts of the brain that are cranked up and on fire. And really, a lot of times, we'll postpone doing treatment at a certain time, sort of waiting on their brain to get to a place that they can retain focus, that kind of stuff. If they continue to have contact, or they have to have contact because of parallel parenting or court or whatever, it just, you know, re-inflames the brain. So
absolutely.
Then there are other factors that contribute to the intensity of attachment in these relationships. And, you know, a big part of that is just the pathology of the partner, that they are intense to experience and they're intense to get away from. So there's, like I said, there's not one easy answer. These are really complicated. It's the worst. I've been a trauma therapist for 30 years, and it's the worst trauma, you know, I've ever treated.
It absolutely is. It paralyzes people in their lives. And it's so, the work that you're doing is so important. I'm learning a great deal from you, you know, right now as we're talking, that I believe, you know, will help me to help other people. So I think I just answered the question I was going to ask you, because I was going to say, you know, why do they think, you know, that the person is going to, that the narcissist can change? And now I go back to what you say, this elevated, you know, agreeableness and perseverance and those kind of things is what makes them believe that person will change.
Exactly.
But, you know, some call it the, you know, the Pollyanna complex, or, you know, or magical thinking, or those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're about 30 minutes into the hour, and I want to make sure that, you know, we talk about what you feel is important. So is there something that we haven't covered that you think is important to talk about?
Well, I think that last point that you made is important, that these are people who get labeled those kinds of things, naive, doormats, Pollyanna, without understanding these trait elevations that are contributing to it. You know, it's like, you know, some of the personality traits include extroversion and introversion. And we readily know that telling a shy, introverted person to go out into the world and be an extrovert is never going to work because it's innate in their personality. Well, it's the same thing with these trait elevations with these women. It gets labeled so many other things. When it is, you know, when it is born with kinds of traits that telling them to be less trusting, be less empathetic, it is unrealistic because they're wired that way. And that really, they can get over the trauma of the relationship and the trauma symptoms can be treated. What their real risk factor is are the super traits because they go with them out into the world, with them into the next, you know, relationship. And that they are exactly who cluster Bs are looking for. And so the real work is not merely reducing their symptoms. It's getting them on the same page of learning how to live with a personality that has trait elevations that places them at risk and how to learn to guard those.
Okay, that's really important. I'm taking notes. I know I can listen to this show again, but I'm taking notes.
You know, we could send, if other therapists got it, we could send them to anybody. Anybody can reduce trauma symptoms.
Right,
exactly. But it's not helping their risk factor. These are the most at-risk people because of these trait elevations. And you can't just say, okay, next time just, you know, be aware.
Don't be so kind and nice and naive, you know, and wonderful and positive and Don't be like that.
Right.
You can't tell somebody
just
and then not be like
just
that.
Stop it.
But you know, one thing that I find, I would say, at least 95% of the women that I counsel who are suffering this kind of victimization have had a situation in childhood where they have created a sense of emotional safety through pleasing. So would you say that that's just a response because it is innate in them and that is a natural, maybe maladaptive kind of coping mechanism? Or do they learn that pleasing is something that will get some – bring some emotional safety to their environment?
Well, that was another reason why we did the research, because therapists tend to assume that that those relationship investment and conscientious displays are trauma-based. They're all digging around looking for the alcoholic family, the early childhood abuse, the this and that. And in our research, over 60% of the women did not have alcoholic parents did not have early childhood abuse. And so, again, I'm just a curious kind of person. It would make sense why they would develop those behaviors if they had that kind of environment. But when the statistics are showing, you know, over 60% haven't had that, then what else could it be?
Okay.
And so four people, four survivors who did have alcohol comes and abuse or violence or sexual abuse in the home, sure. Or maybe they came from a whole line of people-pleasing parents, which might be super traits. But beyond that, you know, for the 60%, the answer does not lie in trauma. And so we have to go back to looking at these super trait elevations as the reason. The other thing about agreeableness and conscientiousness is that they are called cooperative skills. And so it's not really people-pleasing. So someone likes them, a judge, an attorney, a doctor has to have some level of skill in order to facilitate cooperation. And so I think there's a difference between having a trait of cooperation and being a people pleaser. But again, when we go back to, there's been no language in this field until the Institute did the research. We're going to use the words we have, people pleasing, codependency. Yeah. So we didn't really have a better understanding of what that could be. What else it could be.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense. And that's why this work that you're doing is so very important. And, you know, and let's get it right. Let's figure out how to help, you know, help people who are going through this. Now, you said that part of helping someone recover from this is, you know, teaching them how to live with their trait, you know, these trait elevations. Would that be, would boundaries be one aspect of that?
Yes. I mean, every one of them has identified that. And again, I think that's another word that because we haven't had a lexicon language for this field, that people assume these are bad boundary people. And I keep going back to the same analogy of a judge. Do judges have bad boundaries? It's not that they can't, but it's not likely they would end up in the position they have when they have bad boundaries, especially in court. So is it boundaries or, again, is it the super traits? But that definition of boundaries, most of, you know, all of our clients identify with knowing that they need some work in that area. However, what highlighted my curiosity again is that they tend to have boundaries in their career. Where they don't have them is in the relationship. Again, because these two things are connected to these relationship investment trait elevations. So it was truly a boundary issue. I think you would see it, you know, across the board, but that they're great managers, great leaders, great everything at work, but in this one little subset of their life is a problem. So that's one of the areas we're still sort of working on and researching is about, is it really a boundary issue?
Okay. Oh, gosh. So tell us, you know, we're coming down to the end. We have really a few minutes left. So tell us exactly what the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction and Public Pathology Education does. So you educate, you research, you counsel. Is that basically what you do?
Yes. We have a survivor support division that we have, you know, trained mental health, licensed mental health counselors. In my position, I primarily produce all the products and material.
Okay.
You know, drawing on 30 years, I'm trying to get this all down before I retire. And so we have a wide array of, you know, products and services for recovery. We do a lot of therapist training. We do some legal field training as well, and participated in the research and currently developing the first association for therapists in this field. It's the Association for MPD and Psychopathy Survivor Treatment Research and Education.
Oh,
and
I love it.
So it will be for licensed mental health professionals to get our model of care training in how to do treatment.
Okay.
And then our next
project
is we're going to be reaching out to paraprofessionals and providing a similar service in a pathology educators partnership.
Okay.
For survivor bloggers.
Okay. Just in the last 30 seconds that we have, so you have an online magazine called SafeRelationshipsMagazine.com. So that would be www.saferelationshipsmagazine.com.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a good place for my listeners to start getting familiar with what you do?
Yes, that's the main website, yes.
Okay. All right. That is awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you. I'm glad that we were finally able to make this happen. I knew this was going to be a really amazing show, and I so appreciate you being my guest. Thank you for the work that you're doing helping victims, and I know that, like I said, you've helped me a great deal today. So thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Happy New Year, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care,
Bye-bye.
Sandra. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
So we are out of time for today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show or any other shows, you can email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com. And remember, Randy is RANDIGFINE.com, randygfine.com. So thanks again for tuning in and listening to A Fine Time for Healing. This is talk radio show host, author, and life issues counselor Randy Fine, signing off until next time. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randy Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randygfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randy G. Fine.